from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our opening hour this morning, bipartisan political power couple Mary Madeline and James Carville made waves on both sides of the aisle when they got married back in 1993, and 20 years later, they're still at polar ends of the political spectrum. The two will join us to talk about how they've successfully made it work, about their new book, Love and War, 20 years, three presidents, two daughters, and one Louisiana home. Join us for the hour. That's next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. James Carville and Mary Madeline are what many call a power couple, though they have looked through a two-decade marriage and before at power in a two-party dominated political system from different cheering sections. Known widely as the political world's odd couple, he is a Louisiana Cajun and lifelong Democrat. She a Chicagoan and lifelong Republican. An attorney, James Carville was leading strategist for Bill Clinton's successful 1992 presidential campaign and was the co-host of the TV show Crossfire. He presently hosts a weekly XM radio program, teaches political science at Tulane University. Mary Madeline served in the Reagan administration and both Bush administrations and as counselor to Vice President Dick Cheney. She currently hosts a national radio show with Arianna Huffington and is visiting distinguished lecturer at Loyola University in New Orleans. Their most recent co-authored book is titled Love and War, 20 Years, Three Presidents, Two Daughters, and One Louisiana Home. Both James Carville and Mary Madeline join us for this opening Forum Hour, and good to have you both here. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Good morning. We love being in your beautiful city.
Yeah. Right. In fact, James was saying he's delighted by the weather, and we'd like more rain at this point, but glad you're delighted with it.
Well, we'll give you some we've been getting.
You want some rain? Come to New Orleans.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about New Orleans because there's a real love affair going on between you two and New Orleans, but let me start out by saying the two most frequently asked questions of these two people: is your marriage a sham? Is it a political stunt? I must tell you, a long time ago, I decided when I heard these kind of questions that they were absurd because obviously you're two people who are committed to each other. You have what Dan Quayle used to call family values and commitment and all those kinds of things. So why would people even assume just because you're in different political parties that the party is that somehow you are a sham or about this for silly reasons?
Initially that was annoying, but we work in an annoying business of, you know, you have to pick your hills. But the guy, a guy who wrote a review of one of James's books, 2 years and two children, or 3 years, how many years into our marriage and two children later, was still saying we had a stunt marriage. And if anyone thinks that I'd be pumping out stunt kids at age 42 and 45, well, only a man could write something like that. So I don't.
Well, we're getting right into gender
this.
Politics here right away.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, you got two great kids from everything I've read in your book, and congratulations on that.
Well, I don't know. You know, like Jack Benny said, I don't deserve this, but I don't deserve arthritis either, so what the hell, I'll take them.
I don't deserve arthritis. Remember the Benny line. Yeah. Well, again, it's good to have you both here. I think let's go right to the book here, because the toughest times for you, even though you've gotten along, you've had your rough spots like any married couple, but the toughest times were the 2000 election, the recount, and the Iraq War. In both, I guess, instances, stop talking. Politics seeped into the marriage, so to speak?
You know, politics has gotten, it always has been, but in recent decades it's gotten even more emotional. There's a study done recently at Emory where they connected people's brains to those electrodes, and when they were talking, and their brain parts of their brains are lighting up. When they changed the conversation to politics, the rational parts of their brain went completely black, and the emotional parts went all red. Well, that's not a way to have a discussion, and obviously, I'm devoted not just to my party, I'm mad at the Republicans right now, but to the Bushes in general. So that was very emotional for me. It was very emotional for him. We had a two-year-old and a five-year-old at home. Everybody I knew and loved was in Florida. So that became kind of a non-conversation. And then within 5 minutes of the results of the outcome of the recount, I got a call from the Cheneys and I was gone. Well, that caused a little friction in the marriage. Not that we ever considered, or I never considered breaking up or divorcing or anything like that. You just got to ride it out, baby, ride it out.
Just some friction. I've got to ask you why you're not happy with your party now. Those are your words. Or why you're less happy? Or what's going on?
You said in your introduction that I'm a lifelong Republican. I am not. I grew up a Democrat and a liberal.
Oh, Chicago.
In South Chicago. But I'm an empiricist and a constitutionalist, and I don't think compromise is I think it's a dirty word, all this silly stuff you hear on TV. I think there's some things that are uncompromisable. The Compromise of 1850 didn't solve anything. We have to do something about entitlement reform or structural debt. We have to do something about income inequality. I agree with this. We might have different solutions. We have to fix education. There's myriad subjects that I find Republicans offer a milder version of a Democratic answer, and they've become less outcome based and more happy intention based.
So you're more with the Tea Party, more with Ted Cruz?
Yeah, I think I'm gone for full tilt Tea Party, but not. I'm not Tea Party. That's not Tea Party. It's nothing to me. Constitutionalism, federalism, outcome based stuff. We talked to him on the way in here today. Our mayor in New Orleans is a Democrat. I fully support him. My heart pounds for him. We are outcome based. If it works, we're going to try it. We're going to do it. And if it doesn't work, we're not going to keep it in place because some crony got a job off of it. I mean, you're more accountable closer to the people. So it kind of conflates with my the essence of Catholicism, which is subsidiarism and solidarity. So more complicated than...
I want to jump in there because people aren't... My mother used to say, don't talk about politics, religion, or sex.
But and that's all we ever talk about
right,
now.
More but you did do... I mean, you converted to Catholicism, and from what I'm reading, you're more religious than this Catholic-born guy next to you here. Or at least more pious.
No, I'm you know, cradle Catholics, it's a gift to a convert. It's a gift of grace. I'm so grateful every day. It's a journey, and I'm curious, and I go to Fender Rome twice already this year. James knows everything. He's pre-Vatican II altar boy. He can do everything in Latin frontwards and backwards, and he's a very good guide for me. But he's a social garment. We're different kinds of Catholics.
Social garment Catholic. That's a new term for me. James, let me talk with you about some of the same things I'm talking about with Mary. That is, in this case, I guess I want to think about the high point, as you point out, for you was the 1996 reelection of Bill Clinton. But there were low points, too. I mean, Monica Lewinsky, Whitewater.
Right, sure. Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of them. 20 years. You have highs and you have lows. I mean, there's no question about it. And I mean, one of the things that prompted me to want to write this book is Mary and I have been, I said ringside, and somebody said more like in the ring for some of the biggest stories in the last 20 years. Obviously, the around the impeachment was a huge, huge, all-consuming thing, the recount, the Iraq War, the Katrina reconstruction. So I thought that we were, in many ways, I don't know, fortunate is the word, but we were sort of there and was sort of a good time after 20 years to chronicle some of that. If you think about it, I was probably the designated defender of President Clinton during that time.
I used to think about you like Chuck Colson used to say, I walk over my grandmother for Ronald Reagan. They used to say that about you with Clinton. No?
I guess, and I was glad I did it, but it was...
You used to say about your wife, about Cheney,
absolutely.
I guess,
or
the Bushes.
Yeah, so we have had this sort of long time being a vortex thing, and it kind of ends or is going on, but the move back to New Orleans and being involved in what's going on down there and everything that's happening there is... We've had a very good view of
you got a
lot of
big distance
events.
From it, maybe. But you also, I say get a little distance being in New Orleans now and being away from Washington, the center of all this. But the fact of the matter is that you both have different views. How do you work together as writers on this? I mean,
she writes her part, and I write my part. And a book of some of a little bit, what we'll take the same that the editors did a very good job. So there's some chronology to it, okay? But it's not like, you know, you don't get half of me, you know, it's not diluted. It's me and my voice and her voice. And it goes back and forth. And you'll have a different take on a lot of different events because the same thing is seen through two different pairs of eyes.
But you don't really fight over politics. You don't fight over religion, obviously.
There's fighting and there's exercise to kind of conversation. To your previous point about either of us walking over crawling over a crushed glass at rush hour for our
respective grandmothers, but that's
grandmothers. Whatever. The commonality there is loyalty, and to this day, he is friends with the Bushes. I am friends with President Clinton. I just got a picture with President Clinton and our youngest daughter. President Clinton turns out is an aficionado of unique and hard to get antique Italian furniture. Who knew? You know, stuff that James wants to shoot me over. Clinton's like, let's show me that Corona. That's a 14th century Italian Corona. So the essence of it is loyalty. So when we fight, we're loyal to what we disrespect in other people and love about each other is loyalty to whatever it is we're being loyal to.
Well, you're loyal to each other. You're loyal to your family.
Yeah, I guess if you get one of the things I've learned over 20 years is sometimes you just let things go. Okay? You just got to, it's not, I'm not going to change her. She's not going to change me.
It's a lesson of many long married people. I mean, you know, you talk about religion and politics, but the book has some things about, at least the promotional material says, well, you know, is this a marriage where makeup sex is different and what's like having sex with a Republican? All that seems to me to be promotional material because I read the book and it don't necessarily bring us into your boudoir, nor I would think would either of you. From what I know about both of you, but it's been good on that score.
You know what? That was not promotional material. We didn't write the promotional material. Obviously, they did, but that is all true. We've been talking on the lecture series for many years, 9 presidential campaigns, however many it's been, and people without fail ask us about our sex life. And I'm a Midwesterner. My mother said what your mother said. Never talk about religion.
I'm a Midwesterner, too.
Sex. Sex was their bone. You never. And the idea is like, do you guys just, are you just different parties so you can have makeup sex? And I'm like, who would ask such a question? Every single question we put in there about what was asked of us. And it's curious to me that people would be so curious about, or they'd say to me, he has to be great in bed. There's no other explanation. I mean, what? How do people live out there? To me, that's interesting.
They live as voyeurs. You're famous people. And that's the name of the equation here. We're talking, by the way, if you just joined us, with James Carville and Mary Madeline, who have a new book out. It's called Love and War, 20 Years, 3 Presidents, 2 Daughters, and 1 Louisiana Home. And as I said, this is kind of a love affair with New Orleans. I was struck in reading about your going back to New Orleans with, not only your role in the last Super Bowl. I was going to ask you who you're rooting for here, but now that the 49ers have taken care of the Saints.
I pick against the point spread on the Tony Kornheiser radio show. And this morning,
a sports show now, we should mention.
I did. I got purged in the merge.
Yeah.
I took the 3.5 points in the 49ers.
Well, good, because we were just talking before we went on the air. I think they're giving, you know, and these odds makers get pretty close to the bone, given the Seattle Seahawks a couple of points on that. I didn't think we were going to talk about football here, but I want to talk about New Orleans, actually.
Okay,
because
go ahead. Sure.
Poppy Bush, as you call him, Mary. The one thing he said in his autobiographical or memoir book that he regretted the most was that, and it wasn't even so much regret, I think, it was just that he found it hurtful that they had said he was racist and all of those kinds of things after Katrina.
Poppy Bush?
I'm sorry, Bush Jr. I'm sorry, Poppy. You called Bush Sr. Poppy Bush.
Yes.
W.
And we all missed the velocity with which that turned into a racist political conversation. The truth is, St. Bernard's Parish, which is all white, okay, it's not nearly as refurbished and redone as New Orleans does.
Are you going to be doing some refurbishing through Bill Clinton's advice now in terms of your
own
place?
But the point is, no, I mean, he didn't see it coming. He didn't see, and there was so much that there's only so much the feds could do. What we did learn is the necessity of, and you can see this, we knew it after 9/11. You saw it after Sandy. In New Jersey, you had to have very good coordination between first responders, state responders, fed responders, and not and get in each other's way. So without reliving all of that, yes, because that is the last thing he is a racist. And to this day, you cannot go into a library or a school that doesn't have a sizable Laura Bush book section, book grant, and they continue to provide a lot for New Orleans anonymously. And Mrs. Bush is just their last year, I think, for one of the Mardi Gras things. So
but who was the horse guy who he said, you're doing a great job?
What?
The guy who had about as much experience with disasters as, I don't know, maybe our new interns or something.
They're insulting you new interns.
No, it's not an insult. You know, I don't think any of them are equestrians.
Let me jump in here.
James Carr.
I certainly don't think that the lead up to the storm was right. The immediate aftermath was lacking. I give credit. I mean, to President Bush and the Congress, the reconstruction is going, I think, better than anyone would have expected. And some of it, and I give credit to people first and foremost. You got to understand, and this is very important. When I refer to it, I only refer to it as the engineering failure of 2005. Because what happened there, what happened in Orleans, or New Orleans, and St. Bernard, which Mary referenced, was not an act of, we think of an act of God. The structures in place were supposed to be able to protect us from that. Mm-hmm. They did not. Now, what happened on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, where we have a place in Bay St. Louis, that, hey, you have a 26-foot storm surge, what are you going to do? All right? The thing would be if you're in a building here and you have a 4.2 earthquake, the building is not supposed to fall down. If you have a 9, you're done.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Okay?
It was an engineering problem.
It was a massive engineering problem. Now, it's also important for people to know that the engineering, according to even the most skeptical people, is much better today. Mm-hmm. Now, this is just part of the sort of risk profile. But I will defend President Bush 43 that from 2-3 weeks after the storm, all right, they did a good job. They sent Don Powell down there, who did a very good job, who was very well respected.
General Honoré, stuck on stupid.
And, you know, did some things. And you got to look, and you just, if you just sit there and don't be perspective, you lose a lot. And now we're the fastest growing city in the United States. It's a little bit because our population dip so far is coming back. We've been rated like number one for entrepreneurship, number four for growth. Every week there was 800
National
people
Geographic.
In San Francisco.
Can we
enjoy
give you
this.
One stat, National Geographic? Tell me.
Right. Well, we were named number one place in the world. But
people how safe is the city? The city's always had problems in terms of its profile being
safe. Our crime rate
is probably
about a 30-year low.
Yeah.
As it is most places. If you come here and go to out, chance it doesn't happen. You go down there and deal and, you know, short somebody on a drug deal, it's probably not too good. All right? I mean, we do have a lower but unacceptably high murder rate. Now, 85% of the shooters in New Orleans know the person that gets shot. Hmm. So it's not so much a random thing. We do have unacceptably high, the crime rate is dropping, but it's too high. The youth unemployment is unacceptably high. We're a city of an urban area that is poor, that has problems. We do not deny them. We try as best we can to address them. But let me give you some other things. There were 809 restaurants in the area on the day that the levees failed. Today there's almost 1,400. The music scene, according to people at Quint Davis, who runs Jazz Fest, and people in other people, has never been stronger. There are more street bands. There's more organic music. There's more people doing this. There's more people moving in. The art scene, everything.
You guys should
there's
be hired by Chamber of Commerce.
Well, no, it's not. It's important. Look, people in the Bay Area paid a lot of money for the reconstruction in New Orleans.
Yeah.
And it's important for the listeners of this station to know that that money wasn't wasted. That there's a real sort of vibrancy down there. And I would remind people in San Francisco that Tennessee Williams famously said that there are only three cities in the United States, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. Everywhere else is Cleveland.
That's where I'm from. Okay. We're talking to Mary Madeline and James Carville, by the way, and their new book is Love and War, 20 Years, Three Presidents, Two Daughters, One Louisiana Home, and we'll get you involved in this conversation. I have to ask you, James, though, I was reading Politico, and you said if Gore were elected, there wouldn't have been a 9/11?
I think he would have been very aggressive on it, and he was very knowledgeable about airport security, but that's my own view, and I've argued it enough, but that is my view.
Yeah. Well, we're going to get some views from listeners here. In fact, let me invite you to join us. You can do that now. Our toll-free number is available to you, and you can join the conversation. If you have questions or comments for our guests, we'd like to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-733-6786, and that'll work whether you're listening on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also go to our Facebook page. So we do welcome your involvement in the program. We're going to go to break, and then we'll bring you into this. But I have to tell you, I was talking to a friend and colleague yesterday who had observed you two. Now, this is just a kind of observational reportage, if you will, at an event, and said, Mary was slamming James, and there's that famous statement out of James Dickey's Deliverance, which I won't go into, but I think you know what I'm talking about.
Right, right.
And James, this person was reporting me, was just sitting there looking at his iPhone or whatever it was, and in a sense, that was the dynamic that came across. That was a public dynamic, too. In other words,
I'm not slamming him. I was quoting from a book, and he has severe ADHD, which is what he's doing right now. He's looking at his iPhone. I would never slam him.
You were asking me. I just
there's a picture of your daughter and Bill Clinton. Right. Nice picture. And yeah. He does have ADHD. He writes about it very candidly and, I think, bravely in the book, as you do about your, shall we say, conflict over animal loving. Most of the PETA people are Democrats probably, right? Would you concede that? You're a PETA person.
I am not an anti-Democrat person, but I want to say, before we switch to that conversation,
we're coming up on a break, so just a quick.
One of the ways we've been able to get our arms around crime in New Orleans, this is important, we want everybody to understand this, is through the efforts of Palantir, which is a California-based company that is helping us with preventive policing. They've been saints, absolute saints, so thank you.
Where are they located in California?
In Palo Alto.
Oh, so they're here.
Well, after the break, I'll tell you a story because it's really worth
it. I'll take you up on that. Right. And again, it's glad to have you both here. And you, our listeners, can join this conversation. We welcome your calls or emails. Toll-free number is 866-733-6786. And you can also email us, forum@kqed.org. And I ought to mention, by the way, just a plug, they are appearing, that is, James and Marilee are appearing at the Commonwealth Club event at the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. The event is sold out, but there is a waiting list. You're popular guys. We'll hear from our listeners when we return on Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, bipartisan political couple Mary Madeline and James Carville made waves on both sides of the aisle when they got married back in 1993, 20 years later. The couple are still at polar ends on the political spectrum pretty much, but we're talking with them about how they've successfully made it work. That's in their new book, Love and War. And we're going to bring you, our listeners, into this, but James, you had a story first.
I had the CEO of a company called Palantir, which is a Palo Alto high-tech big data company, and the CEO, a guy named Alex Karp, said that they wanted to do some pro bono, some charitable work. And what did I think? And I said, we have a really horrific crime rate in New Orleans. And so he came down and met with our mayor. And Alex grew up in Manhattan or somewhere in metropolitan New York, Jewish, kind of secular guy. And our mayor is like Jesuit educated guy. And they both, it was really amazing, both had the same reaction, and that is the utter immorality of young people killing other young people in society, not doing anything about it. And we were able to, at no cost to the city, start integrating data and being able to predict and intervene as to where these conflicts were going to be arising. And we've seen probably a third reduction in our murder rate since this project started. But this is a good example of how when people sort of work together and sort of come at something, because, and it sounds horrible, but a lot of society's attitude is, well, these kids are just kind of, they're shooting each other, you know, as long as they're not coming to Pacific Heights, what the hell, you know, it's not really my problem. And the idea that you would have a really uber high-tech company in Silicon Valley and a mayor look at a problem and have the same perspective of how immoral it is, and to be able to meet with the success that we have. Now, we're still unacceptably high. We still have a lot of work to do, but we're getting much, much better as we progress into this.
And we cannot thank Palantir enough for volunteering.
I wonder if Palantir is doing any work here locally. East Oakland could use some of this, too.
They do a lot of stuff in
LA. Well,
we're
kind of a prototype, and we're going to try to they do all kinds of stuff, but we've been to – I brought that up not just to thank Alex and Palantir, but to let people know, when you're going to New Orleans, we have identified the circle of the problem and have reduced it. And unless you're a cousin of some drug dealer that went bad, you're going to be okay.
Yeah, I would. But again, like any other big city, I would be aware of where I am.
Let's bring our callers in because our first caller actually wants to talk about New Orleans. Jonathan, hi. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. It sounds like you're kind of talking with – I just missed your last little commentary because I was on the phone with your screener. My question was if James and Mary could comment on sort of what's the cultural loss of such economic devastation to sort of lower-income people. I mean, a lot of people have moved back, but a lot of people who were wiped out of the Ninth Ward and other places – are never going to come back, and those people lived in New Orleans for many, many years, and I was just wondering what happened to New Orleans character-wise when you lost so many people in that economic strata.
That's a very good question. And the nature of the city has changed somewhat. The best way to try to give you an answer, it's a very serious question, it's a very good question. The Lower Ninth Ward was a great neighborhood. Most people don't realize this, had high levels of home ownership, right? And the way that it wasn't really a levee, it was a wall. And when the wall broke, it devastated it. Now the Brad Pitt people and the church people have done a wonderful job building different kinds of houses. The population density is not there. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but the best way to describe the city, 40% is better than it's ever been, 30% is getting better, and 30% probably won't get better. But the best way I can describe the problem to you is this. If you live in a city, you have fire, you have police, you have stores, you have libraries, you have all of this, and that is a result of density. A lot of these areas don't have their density coming back. And you also have tons of blighted properties. Now, if you recall, right after the storm, there was a thing about they would build a city out from the high ground, and a lot of African Americans said that was a way to keep them out of the city. So it became that anybody could come back. But now we have a lot of blight, and some of these houses are being torn down, and we're having a density problem. We're quite aware of it. But our culture, you'll be glad to hear this, although we've lost people, our music is better. There were over 1,000 trumpets that were lost in a storm. And that was a figure that scared the living you-know-what out of me, because this kind of stuff is not – you can't study at the conservatory. It's passed down. And a lot of people raised a lot of money to get these musical instruments back in these young people. And so our culture is stronger, But you're exactly right, and it's something that we're quite aware of, that some of the really more lower-income neighborhoods have not bounced back. But it's not a it's a lot of the problem is density and city services.
Well, let me thank Jonathan for that call. We're going to get right to another call here, but have either of you or both of you read Zaytoun by Dave Eggers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's going to be made into a movie now, you know.
Right, about the Syrian guy, yeah.
Yeah. This is Trish, our next caller. Hi, Trish.
Hi, James and Mary. We did an event together in 2004 about single people dating across political party lines for Match.com. Remember that?
Right. I do.
I'm very curious. I remember you mentioned you had children. If you would encourage your own children to date or fall in love with someone from an opposing political party.
Who really? No one. I don't know how you encourage somebody to fall in love. I mean, I had a boyfriend and he had a girlfriend the first day we met, and we weren't looking to fall in love or become a stunt marriage or whatever else, or end up like this. You just fall in love. Love is another one of those gifts.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm going to come back to New Orleans for a minute because I'm in love with New Orleans, and the culture is stronger. And
do you feel a rival here, James?
No, I guess, you know, one of the my kids are your question's good. I would encourage them to fall in love with somebody that loves them back, and I don't really care if it's what their political party is.
There are a couple of web comments here that are appropriate. I just want to read these quickly. Christine writes, "Bravo to this engaging, brilliant, and inspiring couple. As a yellow dog Democrat married to a Reagan Republican for almost 29 years, I can tell you that the foundation of this marriage boils down to one thing, respect. Respect for each other as persons, respect for the intelligence of the other, respect for the space for different approaches, different opinions, different answers. During their years growing up, our two now grown children would run from the room during election years when Mommy and Daddy were discussing politics, but all has always turned out well. And one is now a registered Republican, one is a registered Democrat. Can't get more balanced
Bingo.
Than that."
Bingo! See, kids you think when we're debating, having a discussion, kids think that's a fight, and therefore they don't like politics as they think we practice it, but they have a lot of civic engagement, and one is one and one is the other, and that's well said, and we do respect each other. But an important point that listener made was space. He has his own TV room, bathroom, closet.
Well, wait a minute. What he tries to do with you and your pets? Is he giving you all the space you need there?
My pets are not allowed in any of his spaces.
Well, now here's another side of the coin. An emailer, Steve, asks, people wonder about the marriage because all politics is deeply, deeply personal. So how can two people who disagree politically and therefore personally on some fundamental issues be married? That's why people wonder about this marriage.
Well, let me address that. First of all, people's religion is deeply personal. Lack thereof is deeply personal. We're not amazed when we see a secular person married to a devout person or a Jewish person married to a Protestant, anything else, all right? You have tons of people that have kids from formal marriages that get married, and they really don't like each other's children, but they're married and they deal with it. It is utterly common in the United States that people can't stand their in-laws. Utterly common. No one says, God, I hate my mother-in-law. Gee. All right. The question is, what would you rather be married to? Somebody hates your politics or hates your mother? I mean, what's more personal than your mother? Well, we don't say anything. We laugh if somebody hates in-laws. My point is simply this. It works for me. If it doesn't work for you, that's okay, too. It's just me.
You're both pragmatists. But let me read another listener comment, though, because this is kind of fascinating, all this kind of different opinions and different experiences and narratives from people. Here's a listener who writes, we've got your guest beat. I'm a usually Democratic voting independent atheist married for 32 years to a devout Mormon, Tea Party leaning cradle Republican. Her solution to our political differences is that she won't talk politics with me. That said, I'd say our secret is that it's more important to agree on other things, which we do. Where to live, Palo Alto, what to do with money, live within our means but not skin flinty, where to go on vacation, mostly scuba diving in Indonesia, respect each other's beliefs and not try to undercut them, to resolve conflicts quietly and value compromise, which has often turned out to be better than what each of us wanted originally. Ultimately, what unites us is that we have similar temperaments. That turns out to be much more important than if we agreed politically but had conflicting temperaments.
See, both those listeners are brilliant because the thing that would be most off-putting to me, I could never imagine being in love, in like, in have any a bit of attention to somebody and it, who had no interest in politics. People come up to me sometimes and brag and say, I hate politics. I don't know anything about politics. Like, what are you? I mean, you know, the whole country depends on an informed citizenry. But they're right. If we're not, we haven't persuaded either of each other on any subject in 23 years. Life is short. Yeah. I like to expend my emotion on things that I love when we love a lot of similar things.
I just sit here. I'm sure that you realize this, but you're a very fortunate guy to have a radio show and have listeners that are this informed and this smart. I mean, we do a lot of interviews.
I would use the word blessed, yes.
Yeah, really, really blessed, and really blessed to be on a show like this, to have this kind of insight from people that listen to the show. And some people just can't imagine it, and that's okay too. It is, you know, you gotta in terms of the kids, I wouldn't want a kid to ask me what to think. You know, if like one of my children came in and says, "Father, before the Congress has a current proposal to raise the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $9.35 an hour, what should I think about this?"
But what if your kid says to you, I want your opinion? That's different.
Oh, it would be different. Yeah. I'd say, well, this is what the deal is.
We do that on abortion. We do that all the time. And we try to work it through. But how boring would it be to live with somebody and you agreed on everything? I don't even agree with myself on everything. I don't even see why this is a weird issue.
But I cannot, there's an assumption that there's a connection between what I say and what my children would do. I cannot get my kids to close a door. How am I going to get them to vote somewhere? I mean, it's just not the way that kids are. They'll come around to something, but they're definitely going to do it on their own time. Not yours. And forget that
we advise them thus. Right.
You could be a ventriloquist for me as a father. Let me get another caller on here, and that's Patty. Whoops, it was a Cleveland caller, and I think I dropped it. So, Patty, if you're listening, please call us back. I got a caller here from Ocean Spring, Mississippi. Steve, you're on. Oh, no, this is James first. James, go ahead. Getting confused here. Go ahead, James.
My James.
Hey, hi. Ocean Spring. Hi there. How you doing?
Good. How's everything? We got a place in Bay St. Louis, so.
Well, that's the next caller. I'm sorry. This is a San Francisco caller.
San Francisco call. I'm great. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm in San Francisco. Hey, I just wanted to say I'm an independent, and there's no one I trust more on any issue when I hear in debates or talking to someone than Mary and James. I love it. Thanks for that.
Thank you. Nice compliment. Yeah, appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And also, I was when I was watching The Assassination of Jesse James, a film a few years ago, I was so surprised to see James come on there, and it gave so much more gravitas to that film. So I loved you in that film.
Oh, thank you.
Tell me any more plans to do some more acting in the future.
You like that better than his performance in Muppets?
Well, what are you more proud of, James?
I kind of like old school, to tell you the truth, but I guess it's all, it's fun. I've done any number of these little cameos, and they're fun. I took my youngest daughter to the premiere of the Muppet movie. You never know what the future brings, but it's been fun doing these little things. But
thespian. I saw your other identities. I didn't know.
G.I. Joe. I had a cameo in the latest G.I. Joe movie, too.
That was the one with Demi Moore, yeah?
I guess. I wasn't the same.
Let me thank James for the call, and now I've got this Cleveland caller back, and then we'll go to Ocean Springs. Patty, hi.
Hi there. I'm glad to hear this conversation going on. Okay. I'd like to ask, we always associate these speakers with top-level government. I'm wondering what your understanding is of or how you got engaged in local government. My thoughts are that we were taught only federal government when we were in school, and we're lacking the curriculum that teaches the local and city and county governments. And what do you talk to your children about with those areas? And Mr. and Mrs. Carville, Maitland, please come to Cleveland. I'll show you around.
All right.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
That's a must. Yeah. Interesting point. You're very
really
involved in local politics now. Yeah.
Very.
Well, I this is, we're coming full circle now. I am a federalist. I believe in subsidiarity. I believe in it works closer to people. And that's because I grew up in South Chicago. You, the Daleys, remember that famous mayoral race? Mayor Daley was out of office. And it was said in the newspaper, if Daley was still the mayor, it wouldn't have snowed. Okay? I mean, it's just...
Excuse me, Mary. I have to say this because I think when they talk about Chicago politics now, it's almost code for Barack Obama heavy-handedness, guile,
but cheating. When I was growing up, it wasn't. And our dear friend Rahm is working very hard there to bring it away from that reputation. But, Patty, you're exactly right. And when the kids were little, I never voted absentee. I would take them with me to the voting booth, and I never didn't cry when I voted. I want them to make the connection between voting and their participation. And they work on projects, which you can locally, that you touch something and you see impact. And you can really see that in New Orleans. You can plant a tree. You can clean up garbage. You can change light bulbs. You can help poor people. You can rebuild the Ninth Ward. So we're not taught that, but more kids are gravitating to doing that because it's a practical generation.
Yeah, this sounds like name droppy, but we were just talking to our mayor this morning, who's in the midst of a reelection campaign. We're very involved and also we were chairman of the Super Bowl a year ago, almost exactly a year ago. So we had to work
co-chairs.
And we had to work with the state. We had to work with every kind of agency that you can imagine to put an event like that on. And absolutely. And I think you make a really good point. It is how impactful that local government, we have parishes, but county, the city, any of these things make up a lot of difference in people's lives. And, if you live in a city, the policy really has a real effect on how you live, where to deploy the police, where the fire stations are, drains. We have obviously big issue where we are, a little bit less for you, is drainage issues. Big, big, big issues. So you're exactly right. And we come to Cleveland, we'll be glad to have you show us around. We've been there any number of times.
Well, I've got this caller now from Ocean Spring, Mississippi. Steve, I think that's familiar territory to James Carville. Hi.
Hey.
Hi. Hi, guys. I'm living in Ocean Springs. Grew up in, born in New Orleans and grew up. My family's actually from Franklin.
Washington Parish.
Yeah.
I had a good friend, Lonnie Miles, played for LSU. Was in fact a good friend of mine.
Probably have half a dozen relatives, including my brother, that played for LSU. Sorry about this season. I'm sure we'll be better next.
Yeah. Well, we have a place in Bay St. Louis, so we're kind of midpoint between you and New Orleans.
I got to say, I'm sorry about you, since you talked about your giving the 49ers a advantage here. I was really sorry to see New Orleans go down, not only because it was Seattle, but also because I'm rooting for them. I want them to come back after Katrina. But, Steve, go ahead.
Well, one of the things I wish you guys would talk about is this is not going to surprise James. It may surprise some of your California listeners. The public education system in New Orleans pre-Katrina was essentially third world. I had wife's mother is a curriculum advisor and a superintendent of another district in Louisiana, and one of her former bosses went to New Orleans to try to work on it, was there about 3 or 4 months, and had wanted her to come down because she'd always been her right-hand person, and told her basically, Lila, this is hopeless. I would never bring my worst enemy into this. I'm getting out of here as soon as I can. Nothing can be done. And I think when Katrina hit and wiped it down, and I guess essentially, James could always say, federalized the school system. And as a result of that, and when you hit rock bottom, they've been bringing in different some private, some public, and one of the areas even that where they're bringing all these professors in from East Coast schools and young kids and teaching. And I think that I'm hearing good things about it. I know some things are working and some things are not, but I think it's important if you're going to beat the poverty cycle and everything, you've got to have a functional public school system, and hopefully that's happening in New Orleans, and that'll give the city a chance.
Thank you. A couple of things here. Our public school system was horrific. There is in the public school that is in my neighborhood, in the 90s, I think it was, or maybe the valedictorian had an ACT of like 13, which is like filling your name out almost.
Right.
Okay? And one of the things is Katrina really changed everything. Actually, it was put into place. A lot of the dynamics were put into place pre-Katrina. And this woman you all by the name of Leslie Jacobs, who was uptown family. I think was very, very successful in the insurance business. And she just wouldn't let it stand. And she went to Baton Rouge, and it was actually under the administration of Governor Blanco that they changed a lot of the laws and brought in a lot of charter schools and things like that. There's no doubt that after the engineering failure, it accelerated the pace of change. But the pace of change was already in place prior to that, and in a large measure as a result of a kind of citizen activist, as you will, who really took this cause up. So that's the narrative sort of pushes on, and now our scores are vastly improved, and it's gotten considerably better. Obviously, like any urban area with a lot of population is still living, in poverty or near poverty, we still have any number of problems, but let me butt in here.
Because this is very important. Whatever the reforms that were talked about and put in place before Katrina, the absolute devastation of Katrina insisted that we start from scratch. We have the highest number of TFA, Teach for America. We have a very high number of young people from California who made a lot of money here in Silicon Valley and came and became principals. We have Knowledge is Power schools. We have the number one education reform improvement in the country because of these various programs that we're putting in place. And that's
big support is Lorraine Powell.
Eli
Board.
Well, you both seem like you're on the same team here. In fact, I'm looking at an email from a listener who says they share a love of New Orleans. Do their respective political ideologies lead them to different views on how to solve problems in the city of their common affection?
Well, yeah, it is. And, I mean, one of the things that people like, in people like Lorraine and people like Eli and a lot of people here have been, my friend Steve Bing down in L.A. has been very supportive. It's been because they see things working. They see a result. And a lot of people, philanthropists, are like, they want to contribute, but they want to see a result. And we've seen some really good things. In some instances, some remarkable things happen. But the whole history of modern public education in New Orleans is a pretty, pretty interesting history. And also, we're a small city. We're 375,000 people. And sometimes it can work much better here in New Orleans and say it could be a place like Chicago.
Well,
more manageable.
Can I just say, so we disagree on the minimum wage. We agree on public education. We agree on kids should not be having kids. We agree on the family structure. We agree on the fundamentals of life. So we're not going to, let's not speak to each other for a week because...
But let's go back to the Fed level for just a moment, because you had said earlier, Mary, that you're leaning more toward the Tea Party and everything. When they shut down the government, you couldn't have been in agreement on that.
Yeah, I don't. What I say,
that was no compromise.
I'm a gridlock kind of girl. First, do no harm. What happened? It didn't affect the economy.
Shutdown.
The last time we were on George's show, George even said, in the numbers just came out.
George being George Stephanopoulos.
Right, yeah,
I call him Snuffleupolis.
Yeah, I think I'm not going to sit here, but to point out that every economic forecast has said took to half to 3/4% off of GDP, from macro in St. Louis to Goldman Sachs.
We don't have to be partisan here. Let me actually read a comment here, Mary, to you from Joe, who writes on our website. If it works, we're going to do it. If it doesn't work, we shouldn't be doing it. That's a quote that you gave earlier. Yet she supports a party that continually, religiously, does things that have overwhelmingly been proven to not work simply because of ideology. One example, in a small sense, is the insistence on things like abstinence-only programs and scared straight or tough on crime programs, both of which have been overwhelmingly proven to not only not work, but do the opposite.
I do not believe in zero tolerance on crime issues because I don't believe in one size fits all. And what we've ended up doing is criminalizing kids for bad decisions in high school. I believe in abstinence programs you got to set some sort of benchmark. And guess what? I'm crossing myself, but I've got my kids through high school as virgins, and they understand. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'd be killing me to talk about this, but it's something worth talking about. I don't think the Fed should be involved in that. I think those should be community issues, but I'm specifically against zero tolerance, particularly for first offending nonviolent pot smokers.
I just want to be clear. I think there's some really dumb ideas. Abstinence only is about as dumb as anything I can think of.
Except
if you want to teach abstinence as part of comprehensive sex education, I'm fine. But I'm pretty sure that every effort since the dawn of man to stop people from having sex has pretty much failed before it ever got started. I would just agree with that listener that this stuff has been study after study after study. But if they want to teach abstinence is an option to comprehensive sex education,
yes,
that's
I'm
fine.
I'm not against sex education.
Okay, well, we agree.
I'm against putting condoms on bananas. Okay?
I'm fine. No, I don't put on bananas. I want to put them on something else.
I would like to know that James has a high testicular fortitude. So that's right. This is one of the things we find.
I ain't going to work on a banana. They got to go somewhere else.
Testicular fortitude. I haven't heard in a long time. This is a public radio program, and you're hearing some unusual discourse here between Mary Madeline and James Carville. And their book is out and available. It's called Love and War. 20 years, 3 presidents, 2 daughters, and 1 Louisiana home. And I'll mention again that they'll be appearing at the Commonwealth Club at the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. Though the event is sold out, there is a waiting list. Good to have you both on. Thank you so much.
Your listeners, you should be very proud of them.
I am very proud of them. And like I said, blessed. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We remind you that you can continue this discussion on our website simply by going to kqed.org/forum. We're going to talk about trauma and the psychological ways of dealing with trauma in the hour coming up ahead with Dr. James Gordon, who is part of the Clinton administration and now is professor of medicine at Georgetown. Yeah. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. And we'd like to thank our interns for all their hard work, their intelligence, their dedication these past few months. Keelan Cronin, Nick Zabrowski, Victor Valle, Angela Johnson, and Aaron Newport. We wish them the best and hope they continue to integrate radio into their futures and welcome our new team of interns. Mariam Jamil, Jack Detch, Marissa Endicott, Hannah Rose Levy, and Danielle Radin. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.